Last, if you can you hear me? If I'm going to keep it like this. I don't know if any of you are football fans, but last night was a football game involving the Denver Broncos and the New England Patriots. And I watched the game more carefully than I've watched a football game before, because I had decided earlier that night, had Tebow won the game for Denver, I was going to ask to be converted today. And because of my late mother's memory, I'm kind of okay with the fact that he lost. First of all, had you not clapped about the death penalty, and in terms of what I did with it, I would not confess, but I don't know, I feel like confessing in this room. I did not withdraw from practice for 6 months. I withdrew from practice for just under 3 months. And I think it's important to set the record straight. And not that I don't mind having been involved in the Zundel case or even having acted for him. The fact of the matter was I was an amicus curiae on behalf of the Canadian Civil Liberties Association. Not that it made it any more noble than acting for the principal, but somehow I feel a little better about having acted for the Canadian Civil Liberties Association and not Ernst Zundel directly. When it comes to crime and crime policy, which is what we're here about today, there are basically two schools of thought. There is the law and order school, and it says, get tough on crime, clamp down, stop coddling criminals and give the police more authority and more artillery, stiffen the penalties, tighten up the prisons, streamline the system so we can put more prisoners behind bars faster and keep them there longer, make it painful, increase mandatory minimum punishments, turn prisons into storage containers, warehouses, punish, punish, punish. For instance, get rid of the gymnasium in the new women's prison in Kitchener and convert it into more cells. Some offenders there are double bunking in what are now cells, units supposed to be for overnight family visits. Make the prisons grotesquely overcrowded. Let them rot in hell. If there are no psychological services or they are practically non-existent, so what? And then there is the school of humanitarians, what the law and order crowd calls do-gooders, meddlers, sentimental slobbers, social workers. The humanitarian crowd says, let's treat the underlying causes that breed crime. Crime is a social problem that can basically be solved by humanitarian measures. Instead of creating a more fearful, more vengeful country that couldn't care less about redeeming the prison inmates or repairing them, getting revenge and permanently differentiating convicted criminals from law-abiding citizens, the money should be spent by creating employment opportunities, human services, reduce poverty, create equal opportunities, educational opportunities, reduce cultural deprivation, oppression, and exploitation. In other words, giving offenders an opportunity to reform. For example, the humanitarian says nonviolent drug offenders are warehoused in prisons without reducing drug addiction or the problems associated with drug use. Jail has no impact on the reduction of drug use and crime. Take the money that is spent in incarcerating drug offenders and fund drug treatment programs, drug treatment diversion programs, harm reduction programs, create alternatives to incarceration, employment opportunities, eliminate mandatory minimums, not increase them. The weapons normally used on the battlefield by both sides in days gone by were the traditional crime indices, crime statistics. Assessing police crime statistics was the primary technique used to evaluate the effectiveness of anti-crime programs. As the crime rate would go up, the law and order crowd got louder. As the crime rates would go down, humanitarians got louder. A great enemy of truth is very often not the lie, deliberate, contrived, and dishonest, but the myth, persistent and persuasive. Too often we hold fast to the clichés. We enjoy the comfort of opinion without the burden of thought. Myths are useful because they provide a theory of events. They seem to make sense. They are widely accepted. And I want to talk about a few of the myths and realities of crime. Myth. The public believes that courts are too lenient on offenders. According to an Angus Reid poll in January of 2010, 62% of Canadians favored the death penalty, up from 48% 5 years earlier. 65% believe that mandatory minimums send a tough message to criminals. 62% believe that long prison sentences are the most powerful way to reduce crime. Canadians read the newspapers, listen to TV reports, and have concluded that our judges are too lenient, way too lenient. I would have thought Professor Tony Doob of the University of Toronto Centre of Criminology put an end to that myth. He did an exceptionally important empirical study in 1983. He gave a control group the newspaper stories, television clips, radio spots where the sentencing of an individual was reported. The vast majority of the polling group thought the judge's sentencing was too low. Then he gave the same control group everything the trial judge had before him or her when he or she decided what the sentence would be: the pre-sentence report, the psychiatric report, character letters, the submissions of the Crown and the defense counsel. And a vast majority of the polling group thought the judge's sentences were too high. In other words, when the public is well informed, they cease to be punitive in their response. Myth. Increasing the severity of sentences will deter criminals from offending. As I said, the 2010 Angus Reid poll showed that 62% of Canadians believe that long prison sentences are the most powerful way to reduce crime. False. All serious empirical research in Canada and Europe over the last 30 years shows beyond a doubt that longer sentences are not associated with reduced recidivism. In fact, they may rather be related to an increase in recidivism. Researchers have found that the certainty of punishment exerts a greater deterrent impact on potential offenders than does the severity of punishment. In other words, increasing the likelihood of conviction is more likely to bring about reductions in crime than tougher sentencing practices, and this makes sense. Nobody who commits a crime thinks they're going to get caught. So if you're not going to get caught, the sentence doesn't matter. Let me talk about some rather embarrassing moments that occurred in Toronto over the years when both sides argued their positions based upon crime statistics and crime rates. One day when Julian Fantino, who was then the chief of police in Toronto, had a press conference. Now, in case you don't know, he's from the Law and Order School. He was asked at that press conference about a recent study showing that violent crime was way down and that nonviolent crime was way down. He went on and on about how people can manipulate the statistics for their own use. Those statistics, he said, were lies, all lies. The journalist said to him, "Well, Chief, this is a study you ordered within your department. These are police statistics. It just came out." Chief Fantino said, "Well, we'll see about that. And then in 2002, when the crime rate was down based on statistics, Chief Fantino at the time warned against complacency brought about by the crime is down refrain. Fantino called it the, quote, so-called decreases in crime statistics. Murder had taken a holiday in Canada. It had tumbled dramatically, and Fantino said, don't enjoy the fact that we're a safer people. People, be scared. Citizens, be afraid. But this was no statistical blip. The decreases were real, but not to Chief Fantino. He was angry as hell, if I can use that word here, at statistics suggesting crime is declining. He said in that same year, Torontonians are being lulled into a false sense of security. It bothers the hell out of me, he said. He was talking then about a plunging crime rate. The decreases were real, but our chief of police was upset. In those days gone by, he would have been the first to rely on statistics if crime rates were going up. Yet he had the gall to suggest that homicide rates only appeared to be lower. And listen to this. Because doctors and paramedics were saving the lives of more and more people. He was saddened by the fact that the medical profession was getting in the way of his statistics. Never mind that if there had been better medicine 100 years ago, fewer people would have died and the homicide rate would have been lower then. He called the statistics rhetoric. So he scared the H out of the people. Enough, twice is enough. When things are clearly better, when fear rationally should be decreased, he should have been the first to say, great, this city is safer. He could even lie a little and take credit for it. I could live with that. But no, he wanted police helicopters. He wanted $600 million to deal with crime. He wanted power. He couldn't get it if crime is down. He can only become more powerful if he kept that fear level high. Emile Durkheim hit the nail on the head when he said a century ago that our perception of crime will remain constant even in a society of saints. Chief Fantino went on in his irresponsible state of anger. It's almost as if we've developed a tolerance for crime, that we should be happy that fewer people were murdered last year than the year before. Of course we should be happy. Of course things were clearly better. He was essentially saying that any tolerance of crime is unacceptable. Well, George F. Will put it best when he said we should have zero tolerance for zero tolerance. Zero tolerance is nonsense. It's my thesis that when we look at the entire range of human history, it becomes apparent that crime in general has subsided, never to reach those earlier heights again. When we look at the biblical origin of humankind, Adam, Eve, and Cain committed terrible crimes. And after Abel was killed, all survivors, or 75% of the first four human beings, had criminal records. Now that was a real crime wave. In fact, that was the highest crime rate in recorded history. So in the face of these crime statistics embarrassments, the government finally has figured out how to deal with crime statistics. Because right now we live in a time where the crime rate, and especially the crime rate of violent crime, is in steep decline. Murder in Toronto is at a 25-year low. We should be ecstatic about the incredibly low crime rate. We should be happy. I'm not. In fact, I'm downright depressed. It's bad for my business. But in days gone by, logic would have dictated that when the crime rate reduces, the get-tough crowd should ease up a bit. But not now. Not Stockwell Day, not Vic Taze, not Rob Nicholson. Stockwell Day said, well, I don't know about these statistics. Unreported crime is rising dramatically. So he said we should be spending just under $1 billion to create more cells, more jails. People, he would say, don't get fooled by crime statistics. Well, if unreported crime is rising, they want to build cells for whom? For the unreported criminals? Faced with a crime rate that is ever decreasing, the Minister of Justice, Rob Nicholson, now says, in order to end the crime statistics debate, this is what he says recently. We don't govern on the basis of statistics. Unlike the liberals, we do not use statistics as an excuse not to get tough on criminals. On his logic, as the crime rate reduces, build more jails and get tougher on crime. In the end, when crime disappears completely, there'll be an incredible number of empty penitentiaries throughout Canada, but that's fine. We can turn the empty prisons into Holiday Inn Express motels. We spend $85,000 per person annually to keep somebody in a provincial jail. To house a woman in a penitentiary, $345,000 per person. To house a man in maximum security, $224,000. To house a man in medium security, $141,000. Minimum security, $140,000. It costs us $40,000 per person for people on parole. One would think when you increase expenditures for punishment, you would want to make pretty sure that it was an effective way to reduce the total amount of crime. One thing that this government does not care about is developing policy that will have any beneficial effect on the reduction of crime. For example, this government loves minimum sentences. It has created a whole set of new ones. Never mind that the Americans have come to understand how wrong they are. This government says that it is doing it to make our society safer. Everyone seems to know that mandatory sentencing schemes deprive judges of their inherent authority to fashion sentences that fit the offender and the offense. Judges don't like them. The U.S. Sentencing Commission did a survey last year, and 65% of the federal trial court judges in the United States said the mandatory minimums were too high. None found them too low. Such a survey in Canada, I believe, would produce the same result. And the irony is this, that in toughening sentencing for criminals, the prosecutors now have the discretion to use mandatory minimum sentencing to gain greater leverage to extract coercive guilty pleas from defendants and reduce the number of cases that go to trial. So the discretion has been taken out of the hands of the judges, where the judges exercise that discretion, judicial discretion, in a public courtroom. And it's now been given to the prosecutors who exercise their discretion in their offices. The prosecutor knows that it's a lot easier to get a conviction without having to go to trial because they use the leverage of the mandatory minimum sentence. You plead your client guilty, and we won't use the section requiring mandatory sentencing. That's what it's become. And so the culture that is created in our courts is that everyone now acts with the assumption that the case is going to end with a plea. And when you have that attitude, you penalize people who have the nerve to go to trial. You ask how many times is a mandatory sentence used as a chip in order to coerce a plea? Well, unfortunately, they don't keep records. But I believe the prosecutors have grown more powerful than judges by the transferring of the sentencing discretion from the judges to the prosecutors. We hardly have any trials where mandatory minimums are involved. The judges have lost the discretion, and that discretion is accumulated in the hands of the prosecutors, who now have the ultimate power to shape the outcome. Most judges, as I said, believe that mandatory minimum sentencing causes sentences to be unduly harsh and disproportionate. They disregard the offender's circumstances and the culpability of that offender. A system that statutorily mandates a judge to give up on people is what this government is attempting to create. How does anyone balance punishment and rehabilitation in the face of mandatory minimums? Mandatory sentences waste lives, families, and scarce public resources, warehousing nonviolent drug offenders without reducing drug addiction or the problems associated with drug use. And they have a scant impact on the reduction of drug use and crime. More than two decades of experience in the United States have proven that the substantial costs of incarcerating drug offenders would be better used to fund drug treatment and harm reduction programs, alternatives to incarceration, employment opportunities, and human services. What is our government proposing? Well, they're going to impose a mandatory minimum penalty of 6 months for growing as few as six plants of marijuana. If you have six plants of marijuana on your windowsill, you're going to get a minimum of 6 months in jail. Five plants, no minimum. Four plants, no minimum. Six plants, 6 months in jail. It is said that the law is the omnipresent teacher. What's the lesson that we're being taught? The lesson is simply this. This policy, as all crime policies, is based on fear. Fear of criminals and fear of people who are different. There was even a poll in Canada that actually showed the opposite of this, that showed that 93% of Canadians do feel safe from crime. Why are we spending billions of dollars to go backwards? Let's look at pretrial custody. On any day in Canada, we have more people in pretrial custody than actually serving sentences. Pretrial is, they're still presumed to be innocent. An old, novel, cute concept that we have in this country. And the ratio now is roughly 60-40. Pretrial 60, actually serving sentences 40. And that's a complete reversal from what happened before the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Then the ratio was 40% in pretrial custody, 60% serving sentences. And prisoners before trial are often being held in worse conditions than prisoners serving sentences. The constitutional guarantees of the presumption of innocence and reasonable bail seem illusory. The pretrial remand situation is even worse for some of the most marginalized of our society. Aboriginal adults represent almost 20% of the pretrial custody population. Aboriginal youth represent 25% of those in pretrial custody. Think about it. One quarter of the children that we're holding in our detention centers awaiting a bail hearing or a trial are Aboriginal children. And yet, the debate in Canada was largely focused on how much credit or reduction of the ultimate sentence inmates would receive for time spent in pretrial custody, whether it should be 1 for 1, 2 for 1, 1.5 for 1. Of course, it has now become the law that it is 1 for 1. Unfortunately, onerous pretrial custody itself is taken as a given, as an inevitable consequence of our system. The Harper government is also recklessly blurring the distinction between adult and young offenders. There have been numerous states in the United States that have concluded that older adolescents differ significantly from adults in their capacity to make sound decisions and benefit more from systems focused on treatment rather than on incarceration. It has become much more recognized in the United States that for many, if not most, youthful offenders, the juvenile justice system is better able to redirect their behavior, in large part because of the greater availability of social services. And then in 2005, the United States Supreme Court in Roper versus Simmons outlawed the death penalty for defendants who were younger than 18 when their crimes were committed, because of, quote, the general differences distinguishing them from adults, a lack of maturity, greater vulnerability, or susceptibility to negative influences and outside pressure, including peer pressure, and an undeveloped sense of responsibility. None of these characteristics, though, are unique to the imposition of capital punishment. Rather, they're the general lens through which punishment of children, in my view, should be viewed. By the same reasoning, sending young offenders to adult prisons is a gigantic mistake. The Americans have come to understand through experience that sending juveniles to adult prisons turns them into bitter and frustrating adult criminals. Rehabilitating them is what is important, and the very best chance of rehabilitating a young person is not in jail. Money that this government wants to spend on locking up young people should be spent on rehabilitation. But the government says without any supporting evidence that the act is broken. It's dysfunctional. There's absolutely no explanation of what Prime Minister Harper means. But we do know that he plans to reformulate the 2002 Youth Criminal Justice Act and inject new language into the act that emphasizes the protection of society rather than the care and rehabilitation of the offender, and directing Crowns to consider seeking adult sentences for young people convicted of violent crime. And I repeat, unlike adults, youths in the correctional system have unmet physical, developmental, and mental health needs. I would have thought this observation is self-evident. Now, these three central policies by the Harper government are what I believe to be wrong-headed, misguided, and deeply offensive policies. Our current government is obsessed with building a legacy of being tough on crime, despite all evidence of how unnecessary and counterproductive such policies are. Regardless of lower crime rate statistics, regardless of evidence that longer prison terms do more public harm than good, regardless of the fact that U.S. history has shown us that tough-on-crime policies actually produce a more dangerous society, not a safer one, our government still blindly relies on safety as the primary justification for its policies. The government throws out the term safer streets like it's going out of style. Logic, intelligent argument have been replaced by the phrase public safety. The government is wrapping its crime legislation in the cloak of public safety. In my view, it is immoral and misguided to play on people's fear of crime, to develop policy motivated by fear. I have no problem with being tough on crime, but we should commit ourselves to being, as it is said, smart on crime. We need to adopt what works. And what we really know for sure, what is really true in sentencing, is the following. One, imprisonment is as irrevocable as death. Two, punitive prosecutors and judges don't stop crime. Three, incarcerating offenders who could be given non-custodial sentence does not reduce the likelihood they will commit further offenses. In fact, incarceration may increase the probability of recidivism. Four, first-time imprisonment offenders increase the likelihood that they will reoffend. Five, a conservative British Home Secretary said prisons, where facilities are strained and units are overcrowded and space for medical and psychological treatment are profoundly inadequate, are an expensive way of making bad people worse. The U.S. went incarceration crazy over the last 30 years, and it's now moving away from it. It was a total failure. So what does the Harper government do? It gets incarceration crazy. Canada and the United States are like ships passing in the night, but we Canadians are the unfortunate passengers on the ship of fools. Louis Laws was the warden of Sing Sing Prison from 1920 to 1941. He started as a serious law and order guy, all for the death penalty. He retired a humanitarian against the death penalty, a strong believer in rehabilitation as the function of the penal system. So he created rehabilitation programs ranging from beyond traditional educational and work programs to programs that encompass the care and maintenance of an aviary and a greenhouse, a near professional level football team, and a Sunday night lecture series that featured people from sports and religion. And here's what he said in his book, 20,000 Years in Sing Sing, that was published in 1932. If prison were an effective method of handling crime, there might be an excuse for it. But we know that it is not. With the advent of long prison terms, crime has increased. It is still increasing. An arid desert patch cannot be transformed into a fertile, fruitful garden by a spasmodic spraying of its surface. It requires irrigation, a constant, unending supply of water, often drawn from great distances, that will seep into the earth and bring fecundity where theretofore was only sterility. Except for a negligible number of lifers, all of our 400,000 prisoners will be discharged to resume their places in society. If they and their successors go forth no worse than they came in and no better, there is no point or purpose in our elaborate programs for diminution of crime. But the evidence is they will be worse. To build bigger and better prisons is to aggravate the problem. For the greater our prison population, the more difficult will be the task of absorption. I want to end on this. In 2009, the Prime Minister, Stephen Harris's former Chief of Staff, Ian Brodie, attended a conference in Montreal, what many people already suspected, that criminal justice policy has become cynically political and morally bankrupt. At that conference, he described how the government's proposed crime policies had been attacked by experts on the basis of the evidence. And this is what he said. That was a good thing for us politically, in that sociologists, criminologists, and defense lawyers were and are all held in lower repute than conservative politicians by the voting public. Politically, it helped us tremendously to be attacked by this coalition of university types. So we never really had to engage in the question of what the evidence actually shows about various approaches to crime. So the minister's former chief of staff, in a moment of candor, confirmed that the government can get away with making crime policy that is dangerous, nonsensical, and counterintuitive, because no one but disreputable people like me, who are considered biased and unworthy of debate, have criticized it. Not that I need stand here to tell you what an important role the Defense Council plays in a Canadian society, but I want to name some of our important leaders who are proud Defense Council in the service of this great country. Sir John A. Macdonald, the first Prime Minister of Canada, he was a criminal lawyer. Prime Minister John Diefenbaker, he was a criminal lawyer. Former Attorney General of Ontario and Chief Justice of Ontario, Roy McMurtry, he was a criminal lawyer. The former Chief Justice of Canada, Antonio Lemaire, he was a criminal lawyer. The present Premier of Ontario, Dalton McGuinty, he too was a criminal lawyer. And former Premier Frank McKenna of New Brunswick, he too was a criminal lawyer. All of them were criminal lawyers. The government has decided to do what it wants despite the cost and despite all evidence proving beyond a doubt that these policies will fail. If they're successful in putting through, as they have in some of the bills so far, the Truth in Sentencing Act, the Serving of Time for the Most Serious Crimes Act, the Eliminating Pardons for Serious Crimes Act, all of these, these prepackaged titles for this new legislation they want to put in. The cost over the next 15 years will rise to tens of billions of public money. The dollars to undo this will be over $100 billion. These moral values that our government insists upon imposing today will be proven wrong to the next generation, and that will occur when social and fiscal costs become prohibitive. Then we'll have to admit the tragic mistakes were made and our own generation made them. It will be impossible to unravel, or very difficult to unravel and to undo. What a pity and what a waste. Thank you. The gentleman in the fourth row, right here, and then next.
Thank you for your candor. And I'm really afraid to stand up in front of this group to say this, but I've just got out of prison in the provincial system, which is much harder to deal with than the federal system. And I agree with you that the whole attitude of the Reform Party, a.k.a. Conservative Party, is a matter of emotional attitude as opposed to paying attention to statistics. Not only did I suffer and was beaten by both guards, verbally, physically, and the people around me in so-called protective custody, what hurt me more was the waste of life from Aboriginals, from people who were obviously mentally ill. I mean, the lineup for medications where I was incredibly long. What does that say? These are not Tylenols. And there's lots of trading going on with that as well. And people generally in society have no idea how bad it is. Lock them up. Get rid of them. Obviously, I've started at a position well above whatever else the young people did. And so I had, with the support of my church family and my family, I'm able to sort of recover. But lots of folks there, as you pointed out, really have no place to go. And all they do is return to, I heard somebody on Friday night at the Dismas Fellowship say, I went back because that was the only family I had. And I couldn't cope in the world outside after 5 years inside, so I just went back. It seems to me, and this is the question I finally get around to, is that human and society's attitudes and emotions have to be addressed to this whole thing, I would say. And in a society where everybody's jumping all up and down on human rights, that a person who has been here for another country or a refugee or a lot of other things, their rights are very important and everybody's individual rights must be protected, it's simply unpopular to think about the rights of the person who's committed a crime intentionally. And yes, I'm guilty of a crime. I don't deny that. And because of minimum sentences, I ended up in a very bad place for a long time. And how, just for the people who, it's popular these days because, well, we don't really know anybody, we haven't done it ourselves, nobody has really kind of brought it to our attention, so let's close our doors and put them away in a place like Penetang or a place like Maplehurst or all sorts of places that really is an endemic cesspool of attitude. The guards are as worse as anything else. How do we possibly, because it's more than a political attitude and money, how do we possibly counteract this not in my backyard and I don't want to get involved and I'm really afraid with some kind of knowledge kind of campaign? Because people won't know until it's in their face what the proper way to go, even though society says, well, we are a just society, a.k.a. Trudeau, etc. You know, so how do we do this, Eddie? I mean, it's a really difficult question, and there may be no answer. But thanks for letting me speak.
looking for me to solve the problem? One of the ways is not to vote for this government in the next election, but of course but it doesn't matter. It'll be way too late. It'll be way too late. And it already is way too late. It is impossible to stand here to tell you all of the little things they are doing along the way that don't even require statute approval by the Senate and or the House, but are doing it by fiat under the parole system and changing the discretion that exists under these systems. It's pernicious, and it's going throughout the entire system. That's what they're doing. The death penalty debate that when I did leave practice and went out into the country, Prime Minister Mulroney allowed a free vote in the House on a private member's bill. The member was from Peterborough. I just had to do something about it, or at least I had to at least try. And when I went out, the public's attitude towards the death penalty was, I think, 78% in favor of the death penalty. And in a short period of under 3 months, it went down to about 58%. And had we had another 3 months, I think we would have got it under 50%, because the theme of wrongful convictions, long before there was DNA, the theme of executing people who may not be guilty was a theme that struck home with decent people. I don't think this country is filled with bloodthirsty or people that are not decent. I mean, people's attitude towards crime is a knee-jerk reaction. If a crime happened and somebody was found dead, my mother would call me and say, "Don't act for the husband who did it." I said, "Mom, he hasn't been charged. I am not acting for him. He's not charged with anything. How do you know he did it?" "Of course he did it." Okay? And my mother was ambivalent about what I did for a living. She was proud of me, and on the one hand, and the other hand, wanted everybody that I was acting for to go to jail. Okay? My mother is just a regular and wonderful and decent Canadian human being who loves this country and doesn't like criminals and thinks that the police are never wrong. I mean, the very guys I went to school with who didn't even do as well as I did, okay, all of a sudden are never wrong. I'm wrong. They're never wrong. And it's hard to convince the public that anybody in this country could be railroaded into conviction. And it's only the advent of DNA that has begun to make us understand that, in fact, there are wrongful convictions. And the unfortunate thing about DNA is that if it's a case that doesn't have DNA, nobody's interested. If it's DNA and you can scientifically prove it, fine. A mistake was made. Whether it was done corruptly or whether it was done negligently or whether it was simply done inadvertently, who knows? But the fact of the matter is that the impulse, and I think people in policing know this, and I think people who are politicians know this, that people want to be safe from crime, and they don't care what it is until they're told, until these things happen. I thought this, what they were doing now, the cynicism that's going on in terms of the, you know, if you were in the criminal justice system, you'd appreciate the slogans of the titles of these new acts, the packaging of these new acts. Let's Get Tougher on Crime Act. Section 1. The short title of this act is Let's Get Tougher on Crime Act. It's become a joke. You never saw a statute that was presented to Parliament that it had some slogan, some advertising packaging slogan for the new Organized Crime Act. And if you go down 30 seconds, you find 6 marijuana plants on your windowsill will get you 6 months in jail. I mean, they have no regard for the intelligence of people. And people, unfortunately, don't have any regard for what our Charter of Rights and Freedoms means. They take it for granted until they get into trouble or until somebody they love or somebody they're friends with get into trouble. Then they understand. And the most interesting thing is when policemen get into trouble and they come to you, or politicians come to you and say, that's the law? And I looked at one politician I acted for and said, you voted for that law. No idea what the impact of what these laws do. They always think, I mean, when you think about bad criminals, you think about Clifford Olson. You think about Paul Bernardo. And obviously they're worth thinking about. But when you take a country of 32, 33 million people, and you have one Clifford Olson and one Paul Bernardo, and then you take a look at the fact that over 3 million Canadians have criminal records, over 3 million have criminal records, and they want to make it more difficult to get pardons. They want to make it more difficult for somebody who's done something wrong when they were 18 years old from getting a job for 10 years because they've got a criminal record. They want to make it harder for that person to get a pardon. And they want to do it throughout the system. And there aren't enough people standing up to them. And now, stand up all you want. They are the majority. And they represent the will of this people. And so that's what's going to happen unless they wake up one day and recognize what they're bringing down on this country 20 years from now. But then again, that's not for them. I do not understand what they're doing. I simply do not appreciate what they're doing. And they think by getting tough on crime, they're going to get reelected. You know what? They may even be right. And they may be able to say these things all they want about us in terms of those of us who they talk about it as if somehow I will benefit by reduced crime, that I will benefit by people rehabilitating. I would have thought I wouldn't. I would have thought just the opposite was important. Make more criminals. When somebody comes in to retain me, let me tell them, you know what? You're not going to just get probation. You're going to go to jail for 10 years. The fee will be double. My self-interest is to promote tough on crime. One of my best friends said to me during the death penalty debate, why are you against the death penalty when what excites you the most is going to a courtroom and fighting juries and fighting for the freedom of the individual and fighting for their freedom from being locked up in jails. And the most exciting fight would be the death penalty. And he's right. By eliminating the death penalty, I have necessarily eliminated a certain element of what advocacy is about, fighting for that ultimate cause, namely the right to live. But we fight for these things because we see, as you've described, what goes on in jails, how dehumanizing jails are. A 6x9 cell, 6x9. You can go home today and mark it off in your house. It's a cell that has a sink and has a toilet and has a bed. That's what you live in. No windows in the Don jail. No windows. But that's no longer the case because we've got double bunking. So now it's a 6x9 cell with no windows, and two people are in there with the one toilet and the one sink. Now, maybe they've committed terrible crimes, and these two strangers who don't even know each other are living together, oftentimes for months. I mean, that's an odd state of affairs, that you end up living with somebody who you don't know and don't know anything about. I mean, life doesn't even require you to be that close to your own spouse. But here you are in a cell. And maybe you've done a crime, and maybe you deserve to lose your freedom, and maybe you deserve to have certain kind of harsh treatment, but not the kind of treatment that a civilized society should be awarding to people, giving to people, even the worst amongst us, deserve some basic rights. And we don't do that. We don't do it, and the jails are insufferable places, and they're going to become much worse. There's no question about it. That's exactly where we're heading, and you think you could stand up and say it and it would be enough? It's not happening, though. not happening. It's simply, I mean, I will not stop doing it, but in terms of recognizing the reality of what this government is doing, is they're very powerful. They're very powerful, and they have a majority. And their own party, or what was their party? Brian Mulroney would never have tolerated this, ever. In fact, quite frankly, I'm not sure of any conservative prime minister that would have ever tolerated the kind of positions that this government is taking. This total disregard for our intelligence. This total harsh, implacable treatment for prisoners because they want to be there for victims. I've never seen a government react to a letter more than this government, so that if one victim writes them a letter, that's whose side they're on. And there's no question the victim is entitled to a place in our system, but so is the accused. And although I'm rambling now, let me just give you one quick example about a victim. I was involved in a case, and it doesn't matter what the case is, it doesn't matter who the person is, it doesn't matter what the violence was or wasn't. All I can tell you is the victim stood up in court and said, I don't want this person to go to jail. I don't. And the judge looked at this victim as if she were nuts and ignored her. If the victim had stood up and said, I want 20 years in jail, and that's what our government's doing. They're looking at victims who seek revenge, who seek this kind of, this thinking that they're going to feel better. How can they, if they've lost a loved one, ever feel better? How can they feel like, you know, justice has been served and therefore I can now go about my life? I can't imagine anybody who's lost a loved one who could ever possibly feel better because somebody has gone to jail. But if the victim is there for, wants to say, I believe in redemption and I don't want this person to go to jail, totally ignored. That's our system. Somebody over there.
We gave. Is this working? We've had half an hour for one question. How's everybody's energy doing so far? Everybody hanging in? Okay. Eddie selects your next.
That person there was...
I have two questions. The first one, like you said, basing on statistics, the length of somebody whereby he or she spends in jail determines that when he goes out, he might continue doing bad stuff.
You're going to have, I don't know whether it's the noise, I'm not hearing your question.
Okay, let me restart. You said, like, according to statistics, if people stay longer in jail, they'll always commit crimes. But suppose if they spend 2-3 days in jail, then they come out. How about the victims? The victims may feel like these people just did this and they spent 3 days in jail. I guess it's not fair to us. The victims may also end up doing the same things, thinking that, okay, I also committed a crime and spent 3 days. So how do you balance that situation where the victims also feel that the justice has not been done because the person did not spend more time in jail? That's the first question. The second question...
I'm sorry. Okay. Come here. Can you summarize the question for me?
I will attempt to summarize the question. My understanding of the question is that on the one hand, if you put someone away for a long time, those people who are the victims of the crime are protected. Your concern is if on the other end of the spectrum, if someone who has committed a crime gets a very short sentence and is very quickly back in the community, how do we accommodate the concerns or interests of the victims? Is that a fair take? Okay. Eddie?
Okay. One of the dangers of talking about criminal justice is the vagary of the question. I mean, the problem is that when judges sentence people to jail, and they sentence somebody to a jail, what you cannot forget is there's a person that's going to jail with the name of that person who's going to jail. There's a human being. There's somebody who, as Professor Dew pointed out, has pre-sentence report, has submissions made, character letters, job references, whatever. This is why we have judges. We have judges to look at this and determine what is fair, what's balanced, what's reasonable, taking into account both punishment and rehabilitation and imposing a sentence. I'm not going to deal with an abstract question. What happens if I get 3 days and come out and the victim is still scared? Well, you know, I won't deal with theoretical things like that, because if you tell me if the victim gets up in court and says, I'll never sleep again for the rest of my life because of these two phone calls this person made to me and harassed me, am I supposed to put the person in jail for the rest of his life because this victim says she'll be scared for the rest of her life? That's why we have a system. We have a system that it's not science. It's not a mathematical circumstance under which you can just inject the facts and somehow come out with a result. Every case involves a person. It may involve an actual victim versus, you know, stealing lipstick from a department store. It's decided by courts. And if the prosecutor or if the public who the prosecutor represents thinks the sentence is not long enough, we have a system of laws. You take that to an appeal, and you go to an appellate court, and you have a higher judge deal with it who can either bring to bear a more just and more fair and a more appropriate sentence or not. I mean, that's the whole point of the judicial system. It's not there to please an individual victim. The individual victim may be overreacting, may be reacting accurately, and it's to be decided by a court. It's not to be decided by some kind of general question that somehow I have to defend the system. Our system doesn't need, we are genuinely, and I don't think people appreciate this enough, we have the greatest, and I say this without reservation, I've been to the United States and I've been involved in a trial there. And I came back with the full recognition this is the greatest country on earth for a whole bunch of reasons. One of them is this justice system. Two are its people, the people who are the judges in our system. We don't have election of people. We have an appointment process that has produced great judges, fair-minded and decent people, whether before they were prosecutors and have now become judges. Some of our greatest judges are former prosecutors and become chief justices of our province and are totally fair. One of them's here right now, former Chief Justice Pat Lesage, who was a Crown Attorney, and one of the best and totally fair. And I never beat him once in a courtroom. My whole career, I was delighted when he went to the bench. Our system has men and women who are very good and do their very, very best and have to take into account a whole bunch of things, including the offender that's going in, because the problem is the offender going in one day is coming out. And who do you want coming out? A more bitter, more vengeful, a better instructed criminal, or somebody who may be on its way or her way to rehabilitation?
Okay, just one piece. I know...
Okay,
I just... I know many of you are finding this mesmerizing. I also respect that, you know, we have taken time more than you expected. So respecting everybody's situation here, I'd like to ask that we have one more question, okay, and then call the session
for
the day.
Well, if others, I mean, I saw my football game last night. I don't need any more. if anybody wants to stay, I'm happy to stay.
Why don't we do it this way? We'll have one more question as a full group. We're going to take a bit of a break. Those that wish to leave can leave, and those that wish to stay, we can have continued discussion. Is that a good compromise?
Good compromise.
Sir? Okay, good. Next question.
Was the Young Offenders Act passed because there were increased young offenders, and we just, or was it that we just needed a different way of dealing with them? And is there a lower crime rate now among young offenders also?
First part I didn't hear. You had it too.
Was the Young Offenders Act passed because we had an increased number, or we just realized that they needed to be treated differently?
Unfortunately, crime policy can be affected by a single event. The Kriba murder can have a tremendous impact throughout the entire young offenders system. I don't know if you recall, I don't remember the name of the Just Desserts murder that occurred at the corner of Davin, DuPont, and or around Avenue Road and DuPont. It receives a lot of attention, and everybody concludes that it's had a tremendous impact in terms of crime. And our view of crime is affected by a single case. It either reflects, writers start writing about it as if it reflects societal change. People write about it as if somehow, we've got to react to this. And you react and catch up a lot of people that don't deserve to be caught up in this. And you don't treat it as a single crime. You treat it as a symptom. You treat it as the way in which society is moving and drifting. The fact of the matter is that just because I told you that we fight the battlefield is the use of statistics, doesn't mean that these statistics are necessarily, they're not science. The statistics simply are not science. I remember in the death penalty debate, as an example, there was one year where there was an unusual number of increase of murders. And I got fascinated by it, and I had to obviously deal with that year. And I went and I looked, and it was the year that Clifford Olson was caught. And so what they did, and what do you do with the fact that he's murdered people over 20 years, plug one in 20 years ago, plug one in 10 years ago. So they took all his murders and plugged them into the year that he was caught. Or if you had a fire in Sherbrooke in the same year where 14 people died in a fire at a nightclub because somebody had locked the back door and set fire to the front door. So you take those 14 murders, Clifford Olser's 14 murders, and you now got 28 increased murders in that particular year in Canada, and you think right away we've become the crime capital of the world. These statistics are not necessarily helpful, and I want to show you something that I brought. 90% of this book represent not just the crimes, but the procedure with respect to the crime, but essentially this is the criminal code. This is the criminal code of Canada, and I happen to be one of the editors of this book. Fortunately for me, a lot of people think I actually wrote it and hire me because they think I wrote it. I did not. Okay? And there are annotations in here as well, but this is the 2012 Criminal Code. I became the sole editor-in-chief in 1978 and have been since 1978, and that's the 1978 Criminal Code. It's just less than half of this book. Called Martin's Annual Criminal Code. The first annual Martin's Criminal Code came out in 1954 and 55. That was the criminal code in 1954 and 1955. This is the code today. Now, what does this tell you? It tells you that every time we have a problem in Canada, Parliament makes new crimes. It's much easier to make a new crime than repeal an old crime. For instance, if I were to tell you, if your bike is on my property and I say, get your bike off my property or I'm going to throw it off my property, did you know that that was a criminal offense? Probably not. Human conduct, I mean, it's not Singapore yet where if you sit on a street, you could be charged with a crime. But we now have thousands of crimes. And it's these crimes that go into the statistical base. We invented a crime because some people thought you shouldn't be, if you call up somebody on the phone twice, that's, they're bothered by it. They're upset by it. So everybody calls the police. And so they call the police, and so they make a crime called criminal harassment. And you think when you look at the section that criminal harassment requires, like a bunch of calls. One call can be enough. And so we've got all kinds of people charged with criminal harassment based upon one call, and now you've got this huge proliferation of criminal harassment charges. The statistics are not, they're there. I mean, they're objective in the sense of the numbers. But in terms of necessarily showing you patterns, they don't. But to just say safer streets because you have a couple of letters from people that are upset at what's going on without any regard to the things I'm talking about today, I think it's reckless. I think it's totally reckless. And if it's in the air that the Young Offenders Act needs fixing, you can be involved in the Young Offenders Act all your life and say, I'm sorry, it needs more of this or more of that. It's not what they're interested in. They're interested in the quick fix and the quick vote.